Hello and welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. Today, I think I was gonna talk about arterial lines, but it's kind of boring. I'm kind of boring myself talking about lines, and I feel like maybe I'm boring people as well. I don't know. So I'm just gonna do some random Q&A today. I'm gonna go through. I've done a couple episodes like this before. I'm gonna go through. I get lots of DMs and questions. Way more, and emails way more than I could possibly address. So I thought I'd go through them anonymously. I won't say anybody. And I'll kind of find some appropriate questions that I think are great to talk about, that probably other people, questions that other people share about medicine. And I'll just do that. Let's just randomly kind of go through some stuff. So let's do it. All right. The first question comes from somebody who says they're an ICU nurse. And they were witnessing a code, a PEA arrest, pulseless electrical activity arrest, and they were taking notes for the code, you know, all the drugs that were administered. And they said, I saw an anesthesiologist push 20 units per mil of vasopressin for a code in the cath lab, and it brought the patient out of it. And this person says, it seems like it was a conjunction with the usual ACLS meds, but I'm just curious if this is the kind of common practice or not. Never seen it pushed like that. So vasopressin is a medication that raises your blood pressure dramatically, right? And it increases your systemic vascular resistance a lot, and it spares the pulmonary vasculature of that. So it does not raise your PVR, your pulmonary vascular resistance, but it raises your SVR, your systemic vascular resistance. So it raises the resistance of your system, of your vascular system, dramatically. It's a very potent medication. It's a really good drug to get you out of a bind really quick when you need to turn a patient around. 20 units per cc. So 20 units is a monstrous, a gargantuan dose of vasopressin. It used to be in the ACLS. The ACLS is the American guidelines for cardiac arrest. It's like the algorithm we use in the United States to when someone has cardiac arrest. It's our algorithm, which is a pretty good algorithm. It works pretty well, I got to say. I do like the algorithm. Giving 20 units of vasopressin used to be in the ACLS guidelines. It used to be. It was taken out in, I believe, 2015, so almost 10 years ago, it was taken out. Without looking into the specific reasons, it seems like a good idea that it was taken out. That is an enormous, enormous dose of vasopressin. 20 units is an insane dose. Just to give you context, so I will give vasopressin not infrequently in the operating room and in the ICU, and I give half a unit at a time. That's how I started out, and I usually bolus one unit at a time. Giving 20 units to a patient, that gives them a dramatic amount of SVR increase that they may not need and actually may be harmful. So if you think of the reasons why someone might be in cardiac arrest, so their heart, right, is struggling pumping for whatever reason. Like they've gone to a cardiac arrest, their heart is no longer pumping blood. That's what cardiac arrest is, right? They might have electrical activity. That's what pulseless electrical activity is. There still might be electrical activity in your heart, like the conduction system. But it's not generating muscle movement of your heart. So if you take a heart that's not pumping well, and it's pumping against your arterial system, and then you raise the SVR even more, like dramatically, you raise your afterload. That's probably not a good way to get your heart to pump well, right? If you're increasing the afterload on a heart that is struggling to produce cardiac output, it's not going to help. That's probably why it was taken out of the ACLS algorithm. So to answer this question, I don't agree with this anesthesiologist's choice to give 20 units of vasopressin. That sounds like an old school way of doing things. I don't think that's an appropriate amount of to give. You should be giving epinephrine in a code. Okay, you should give epinephrine because it has inotropy. It's helping the heart. It's giving the heart contractility to pump. You should not be giving vasopressin in a code. Basically, I depending on the situation. Now, I'm not saying I've never given vasopressin in a coat, but I mean a real full-on cardiac arrest, I'm not giving vasopressin. Okay, I'm giving vasopressin as a rescue medication to try to get someone's blood pressure up to prevent a cardiac arrest. So it's a good drug. Vasopressin's a potent, very, very good vasoconstrictor. It's awesome. In fact, it should be used more. I'm probably confusing you. It should be used more to as a rescue to prevent someone from arresting. Because every time I use it in the OR, we're pretty used to it. Like nurse anesthetist and anesthesiologist, we use vasopressin all the time. But if I use it outside of the operating room, people are like, what are you doing? Like if I use it in the ICU, you know, if I'm like, hey, let's give it, people are in the ICU, people are pretty used to a vasopressin drip, right? Non-titratable vasopressin drip. But when I'm like, all right, let's bolus vasopressin, people are like, what? For some reason, it's just weird to people outside of the OR. And I have to go to grab a code cart, draw it up myself and give it because it's so unusual to lots of people. But I am giving half a unit. I always start with half a unit because, again, it's very potent and it can have a dramatic effect. I start with half a unit because you can really overshoot with the drug. Anyway. All right, next question is, what happens to alcoholics who have an acute medical situation that requires hospitalization? Is their alcoholism managed as part of their stay? Also, do alcoholics react differently to anesthesia? That's a great question. It's a very important question. Very, very, very important question to answer. Because this is the reality, right? So if you're not aware, there are people in this world that consume, there are some people in this world that consume outrageous amounts of alcohol on a daily basis that would absolutely blow your mind. I'm talking, you know, a liter of hard alcohol a day or more. There are people that consume this much alcohol, right? It's a disease. Alcoholism is a disease and it's an addictive disease. And everybody who drinks this much alcohol needs medical help, because they will probably die from the alcoholism. It is an awful disease. Man, can I just take an aside about alcohol? This is probably going to be an unpopular opinion. Alcohol is a terrible, terrible drug. It's an awful drug. No amount of alcohol is good for the human body. I think people should abstain from alcohol to drinking almost nothing. And the normalization of alcohol in our culture is absolutely bizarre to me. It is absolutely bizarre. Sometimes I think of this scenario. Imagine it's like Friday night. I'll get to the question, but I'm gonna editorialize for a moment. Imagine it's Friday night and people are getting off work and they're all like, hey, do y'all want to go to the bar? We're going to go go do some cocaine together. Let's go. It's happy hour. Let's go do some cocaine. Or let's go do some other illicit drug. Do you like that? That sounds very bizarre, right? To me, again, I know this is unpopular and people are going to yell at me. That is the exact same thing as people saying, let's go get some drinks, okay? It is a drug. It is a terribly addictive drug that is awful for the human body and has untold and terrible impact and consequences on our society. It is an awful disease and it's an awful drug. And I think there are many, many, many people that have that struggle, not only with major alcoholism, but the concept of binge drinking has been normalized in many parts of American culture. That is a disease. Binge drinking isn't healthy. I think daily drinking alcohol, again, I guess I'm a bit of a prude. I don't drink alcohol. So take it with a grain of salt. I'm obviously like a prude about this. I think consuming alcohol on a daily basis, in my opinion, my non-medical opinion here, I'm very biased, you probably have an addiction. If you were drinking alcohol on a daily basis, you're probably addicted to alcohol. And you need help. You have alcohol, at least, in the least, you have alcohol dependency if you're drinking alcohol on a daily basis. Anyway, I think it's a terrible drug, and I don't think it should be illegal. I'm not like saying we should have prohibition because would be a disaster because it's so entrenched in our society. Okay, anyway, I'll stop talking about that. So this, getting back to this question, what happens to alcoholics who have an acute medical situation? So as I said, the reality is there are many people out there that consume unbelievable amounts of alcohol, right? And just like any drug, because alcohol is a drug, you get tolerant to your body gets tolerant to alcohol, and you know, you need more and more and more to have the same high, right? Because you get high if you go and get if you are going out for drinks and you're drinking alcohol, you're getting high with together. So again, reframing it, hey, let's go out and get high together. No one says it that way. They say, hey, let's go get drinks, but you're getting high. Okay. All right. I swear I'm done. So the reality is you have major alcoholism. Someone has major alcoholism and they get in a car accident, let's say, and they come in Okay, well, we're going to deal with the withdrawals of alcohol, right? Because alcoholism, like other drugs, withdrawing from it can kill you and it can be very deadly. Not every drug does that, right? Benzodiazepines, alcohol, the withdrawal from those drugs can kill you. The withdrawal from like opiates doesn't kill you, right? The physiological withdrawal doesn't kill you. The physiological withdrawal from alcohol can kill somebody. They can get delirium tremens, they can seize, they can die, right? So it's a very, very important thing. So how do we treat that? How do we be aware of that? Well, some people, you don't know their history at all. You don't know their medical history. So you just kind of discover it, you know? In the United States, we have something called the CIWA protocol, C-I-W-A. And it's a nursing protocol that monitors for the withdrawal of alcohol, the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal, like agitation and sweating and hallucinations and seizure and things like that. I forget what's all in the CIWA protocol because I don't do it. I'm not a nurse. But so if someone's on like medication drips like propofol, that will keep the alcohol withdrawal at bay. So it will because it stimulates the same receptors as alcohol, GABA, the GABA receptors as alcohol. So that will supply that physiological need for alcohol while someone's on something like a propofol infusion. But as soon as they come off that and they start waking up, they're going to start having withdrawal symptoms. And you treat it with benzodiazepines. So that is the most direct answer. You treat alcohol withdrawal with benzodiazepines, typically. You can also treat it with phenobarbital. Okay, these will treat the withdrawal symptoms. So a lot of times, sometimes, you know, let's say it's that patient who you don't know any history. They were in a car accident and then they broke their femur and that was repaired. And now they're in the ICU and they're still intubated. And a lot of times you'll get a heads up from like a family member, like, hey, they drink a lot. But sometimes you don't. And you just kind of figure it out. You start waking them up and they are extremely agitated, maybe combative, and are very, you know, just delirious. They don't know where they are. You treat this with benzodiazepines. Sometimes you have to be very generous with benzodiazepines. And there's different protocols. Each hospital should definitely be a protocolized way. When you score on that CIWA protocol, you give a certain amount of benzodiazepines. Chlordiazepoxide, epoxide, also called Librium, is a common one that's used. Also just Valium or, you know, Midaz, whatever. Phenobarbital, I think, is a great drug, and I think it's underutilized because it self-tapers. You can give a big bolus of it up front. Again, a lot of hospitals have protocols for phenobarbital. The nice thing about phenobarbital is it self-tapers. It has a long half-life, and it self-tapers, and it's quite safe. What can be unsafe is mixing the two. If you give a bunch of phenobarbital and then you give benzos on top of it, it can cause, you know, respiratory depression and the side effects of benzodiazepines. Anyway, I hope that answers that question a little bit. Okay, here's another question. Someone says they're wanting help understanding their EKG results. And I'm not going to give medical advice, of course, you know, personal medical advice, which I don't. But there's you'll see why I'm going to read this question. I think it's a good question. They're trying to get a hold of their doctor. So their EKG, this person's reading they see the report of their EKG, and it says abnormal ECG, which is also another way of saying EKG. And they're just like, they have a lot of anxiety, and their doctor's not getting back to them. About having an abnormal ECG. What does that mean? So I will tell you that an abnormal EKG or ECG doesn't mean much. Okay, if you see that on your EKG, that really you can almost ignore, not ignore it. I'm not going to say ignore it, but it doesn't mean much. That is so broad and nonspecific. So it probably means like nonspecific T wave inversions or something like that. Okay, which are not necessarily, it's not necessarily pathological. I'll just leave it at that. It doesn't mean it's pathological. It could, but I think in the absence of other symptoms and you know, having other cardiac problems going on, particularly if you're worried about having a heart attack, you know, an EKG showing ischemia and positive troponins, if those are negative, the chances of someone having a heart attack is extremely low. Those are very good ways of detecting if someone's having a heart attack. So if you see something like abnormal EKG, if I got an EKG and all I knew was that it said abnormal EKG, and I didn't have any other symptoms, and I was fine. Otherwise, I wouldn't even worry about it. I wouldn't even think about it again, me personally. Okay, another person's asking, I wanted to know how you cope with all the death and dying, right? So I'm a critical care physician, and I deal with dying a lot, you know, I mean, all the time. And as you have more experience, one of the reasons I went into critical care is I wanted to be part of people dying appropriately and helping patients and their families, you know, approach death. And I've talked about this a lot on my podcast, you know, being around palliative care and helping people die. So how do I cope? Honestly, I don't feel like I have to cope with it anymore, because it's, you get used to it. It's such a natural part of my job of, you know, if I have a patient that's not doing well, you know, we do everything we can. And then, you know, it's, you know, when we run out of options, then talking to the family. And I think one of the best, I think my best way to answer this is it has a lot to do with your relationship with that family and that patient as a provider. And what I mean is that your relationship with that, with a patient's family provider, it should be transparent and honest right from the beginning, right? You should be very realistic about what you think their chances are. If you think they're going to die, say all these things up front. I say these things up front, and you gotta get to know this family. And what I say is also, there's no script, there's no template. Every family situation is different. All the family members are different. The patient's different. They're unique. They are approaching the death of their loved one. It is something unbelievably tragic for them. They're shocked. This is one of the worst moments in their lives. They're going to remember these moments for the rest of their lives. They're going to be traumatized by them. So you need to approach it in a new way every single time. You need to get to know that family, and you need to understand their dynamics. And you need to gain their trust, and you need to be transparent and honest up front. So you partner with them from the beginning, like, hey, I tell them my name. I'm Dr. So-and-so. Here's my role. I usually ask, like, you know, what's your understanding of what's going on? So I know where they're at. I explain to them, that's correct. I will, you know, this is when I'm first, you know, a patient is first newly sick and they're in my ICU and we're taking care of them. And then, you know, I say, I think this is going on. I think we'll try this and then, you know, whatever. I'm totally transparent up front with them. And then I answer all of their questions wherever they're at. And then knowing, you know, if the patient is not doing well and they're probably going to pass away and there's nothing we really could really do, giving them space and that time to process and to grieve and to come to the decision that, oh, this is not going to work. We need to say goodbye. You got to give them that space, and it's different every single time. So the way you cope is you just be a part of it with them, be a part of that journey with them. And when it's over, it's over, and you move on. And moving on, I don't know how to do that. I know I do that. I can do that. I don't know if it's just a personality thing. But I, at this point in my career, I can be with the family for a week and try do everything we can to save the patient, and it's done, and we say goodbye and we let the patient go and they go home and I go home, and I honestly don't think about it a lot again. I mean, it's there, it's in my mind. It doesn't depress me. It doesn't bring me down. I find it to be a privilege and an honor to be a part of people's lives during this unbelievably difficult time in their lives and to help them as much as I can, which honestly, I don't think I do much, right? It's just about helping them. And it's not about you, honestly. It's not about you. Like, it's just not. Whatever guilt you may have about your patient dying, or we could have done more. You make it about yourself. It's not about your ego. It's not about you. It's about the patient's family. It's about them. It's not about you. Like, it's over. Go home. You know, and try to just put it out of your mind. I don't know what else to say, but that's what I do. All right. There's a person asking about, they had a loved one who had a brain aneurysm, and they're in the ICU because they had a ruptured brain aneurysm. They want to get more information about it. So, brain aneurysms. So an aneurysm is an outpouching. I think it's a good question, because this can happen. Rupturing a brain aneurysm can happen at random to people. An aneurysm is an outpouching. It's like a weakness in a artery. And you can have that anywhere, right? You can have an aneurysm in an artery anywhere, but in the brain, you have major brain vessels, like arteries, that obviously feed blood to the brain. And you can have aneurysms along this track of your artery, your major arterial system in your brain. These little pouchings are like little, it's like a weakness in the arterial wall. Some people can have connective tissue disorders that makes them susceptible to this. And people can be walking around with a brain aneurysm and they have no idea. And then you kind of hear the story is like, you know, someone exerts himself for whatever reason and that aneurysm. So these arteries are on the outside of the brain, right? They kind of course along the surface of the brain. and they rupture and they leak blood around the brain. That's called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So there's different types of strokes, right? There's like hemorrhagic stroke, which is intraparenchymal hemorrhage, which is a stroke that happens within the brain. Right. And keep in mind, I'm not a neurologist and I don't do neurocritical care, although I have a lot of experience with neurocritical care, but I don't attend in a neuro ICU. So intraparenchymal hemorrhage is like, that's a stroke within the brain tissue itself. An ischemic stroke is where you have a clot, like a blood clot that goes up to the brain and stops blood flow to a certain artery or a certain portion of the brain because of a blood clot. Right. And then you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is blood around the brain. Right. These are different types of strokes. There's watershed strokes. There's actually a lot of different types of strokes. And there's an enormous spectrum of strokes, right? Some strokes are very small, some are large, some are catastrophic. And then there's also subdural hemorrhages and epidural hemorrhage, right, from traumatic brain injuries. That's blood. A subdural is blood that's beneath that dural meningeal layer. Epidural is when it's above the epidural layer. Or the dural layer. Anyway, there's different types of head bleeds, and there's different types of strokes. So this type of stroke is a subarachnoid hemorrhage because it's beneath the arachnoid layer, which is another like meningeal layer beneath the dura. Don't worry about the anatomy if you don't know what I'm talking about. But it's blood. It's bleeding around the brain. Okay, so that is very, very dangerous for the brain. So someone can die almost immediately from a ruptured aneurysm from a subarachnoid hemorrhage, but not always. So they come in and to the emergency department, whatever, and they have symptoms, and then you find a head bleed. You can find one of these bleeds easily on a head CT. So the danger with a subarachnoid hemorrhage and an aneurysmal bleed is that the blood should not be coating the surface of the brain, right? It's irritating and it's caustic to the brain, and it causes vasospasm of the other blood vessels. That's the problem. Causes vasospasm, and it causes swelling. So vasospasm is where the other blood vessels then start to just spasm and constrict, and then you constrict blood flow to the rest of your brain. That is the danger. So this is a very dangerous state to be in. So the way that patients like this need to be managed, they at least need to be in, they need to be observed in the ICU for 14 days. They might have mild symptoms. Maybe they don't need to be intubated. Maybe they're breathing on their own, or maybe they're now comatose because of this. So number one, you have to coil off that bleed. So a lot of times, so if you see a bleed like this, it's not always aneurysmal. But anyway, what's my point? So you go down with neuroradiology, neurosurgery, and from the groin, they can go in and put wires up all the way up into your brain, and they can coil off those aneurysms. They put a little like coil. I don't know all the specifics, but they basically block off that aneurysm, so you stop bleeding from that site. So that's number one. That has to be done. If it's an aneurysm that burst, that caused the bleeding. You can get subarachnoid hemorrhage from other reasons, right? You can just be like diffusely coagulopathic or something like that. Like I'll see these on my echo patients all the time because they're severely thrombocytopenic and they have platelet dysfunction and other problems, and they can just have diffuse subarachnoid bleeding. Anyway, so you have to get control of that bleed, and then these patients are on vasospasm watch, right? There's several different ways to manage vasospasm. One of them is TCDs, which are transcranial Dopplers, which looks at it's a little acoustic window through part of your head where you can look at the MCA artery to see if that's spasming as like a surrogate. That's not like the best way. You can look at Doppler flows through that. That can tell you if your face is spasming. But the gold standard is doing an angiogram, going down. Monitoring, getting Q1-hour neurochecks, monitoring the patients. If they have a worsening mental status, you go down, you get another angiogram. If they have vasospasm, you can do catheter-directed like verapamil, which is a calcium channel blocker to dilate that vasospastic artery. So it's a very dangerous situation. Many people survive this, right? But you need to be on vasospasm watch for about 14 days, from what I understand. Now the date on this may have changed, and the practice may have changed. I haven't done this for a bit. So take what I'm saying with a grain of salt and confirm what I'm saying. But it's a very dangerous situation to be in. But I've seen many, many, many people survive subarachnoid hemorrhage from an aneurysmal bleed, but I've seen people die. It can be extremely tragic. It can happen to young people, where suddenly, you know, young healthy people, teenagers, they suddenly have an aneurysm that bursts and they die, and then they're brain dead, and then they can be oftentimes patients like this are ideal organ donors, because their organs work really well, but they're brain dead. Anyway, hope that answers that. All right, next question is, someone's asking, do you have any tips on how to help a loved one in their interurine residency get through their rotations in the ICU? It's really taking a toll on them. So intern year is hard. I think it's one of the most challenging years. It's 1 year. So an intern year, if you're not familiar, it's the year between medical school and residency. Everybody has to do an intern year. It doesn't matter what you do, what you're going into. And so you're kind of a resident. You're definitely not a med student anymore. You have your MD, you've graduated from medical school, and it's that transition year. And it's very difficult, right? Because you are learning, and I think it's also an amazing year. The intern year is the year that you're really, in my opinion, that's when you really learn how to be a doctor and what it's like to be a doctor, because you have so much responsibility now on your shoulders. You are writing, prescriptions and putting in orders, and you're also learning how to be collaborative with teams of nurses and other healthcare providers like NPs and PAs, and you're navigating the system. And you just have a ton of responsibility. And it's a very challenging year. It does end. It's only a year. It does end. And then the ICU is particularly difficult, right? So I'm an ICU doctor, right? But I remember my ICU year as an intern. I was stressed out of my mind because it's so unfamiliar. Typically, you're usually not that experienced with intensive care. It's scary. Patients are very, very sick. People can be scary to work with, right? Working with surgeons. And if you don't work around with surgeons a lot, sometimes some surgeons can be kind of scary, right? They can be direct and downright toxic, right? Sometimes surgeons can be toxic as well, but they're not, of course, not always. I don't want to perpetuate that stereotype, but it can happen. But my ICU, when I was an intern at my ICU rotation, I was stressed out of my mind for, and I think I did 2 months of ICU, and I did two, but I was stressed. That month was really stressful, and rounding and being expected to know things. And it's hard. It's really hard. Understanding that it's going to end, and everybody goes through this year, an intern year, and you need to take care of yourself as much, whatever you need to do, you need to focus on your own, your mental health, and not take on too much stuff outside of your work life. Focus on yourself, during that time. But it's really rewarding. I loved my intern year. I absolutely loved it because I grew so much. It's an enormous time of growth. All right, I'm going to move on to talking about books. I'm going to talk about two nonfiction books that I've read recently. I've been on a little bit of a... I go up and down with different political books and history books and books about other stuff with my nonfiction, but I've been on kind of a little more of a political reading kick, which tends to happen. So I just have two books that I'm going to, one I'll mention briefly, one I'll go a little bit more into detail. The first book is Doppelganger by Naomi Klein. She's like an activist that's been writing for a long time, who I really respect her opinion. She wrote The Shock Doctrine, which was a very influential book that I highly recommend you read. If you haven't heard of it, or if you haven't read it, you should pick it up. This was her recent release just last year in September. And, I liked it. I think it's a little bit of, self-indulgent. It's basically like a leftist soapbox, a little bit, but she's not, in my opinion, she's not wrong about the thing she's talking about. So, with that understanding, take a look at it. But basically this book is about her and her relationship with Naomi Wolf, who is has become a right wing, radicalized talking head, basically, who's on like Steve Bannon show, and how people constantly confuse her with Naomi Wolf. So this is a very personal book for her, because it's been a source of frustration for her, because like she's constantly confused with someone who has her same first name and is like the antithesis of who she is. So that's why I'm saying it's self-indulgent, the book, which doesn't make it bad. But the book was very repetitive. It's kind of the same note over and over again. And honestly, it's like, I didn't learn anything new from it. But she delves into the current like mirror world that has taken over a large part of mainstream Western culture, with like conspiracy-driven mania and pseudoscience and hyper-individualism with an overall you know, result of fracturing of our culture and communities. These things have always been going on, but it's just accelerated and it's more widespread. She does this through the lens of basically just constantly talking about Naomi Wolf, her doppelganger, and how there's a doppelganger society now. So she makes that parallel a lot. She provides a, I thought it was a welcome framework of neo-fascism and how movements such as like the anti-vaxxer and or the plandemic people are feeding into fascist principles by this concept of the sanctity and the superiority of their bodies over the undeserving poor or immigrants or the fat or fad or elderly people, right? You see this rhetoric all the time, anti-vaxxer people, like, oh, I'm a pure blood. Like, they literally, people say that. And they'll be like, oh, you know, people that died from COVID, they deserve to die because they were poor or fat or old or ugly, you know, or maybe not ugly, but I'm sure some people said that. But she talks about that. That is literally a fascist principle that was used in many fascist regimes, including in Nazi Germany. She argues that something like the Holocaust was not just an isolated event by evildoers, right? But it was a shadowland doppelganger of Western culture, which has committed genocide abroad just as much as Hitler did domestically. And she's right. She's right. She touches on autism. She has an autistic son who has autism. And she touches on eugenics and the overall rise of neo-fascism. And her solutions are kind of the typical leftist platitudes of like class and labor solidarity, right? Which I, you know, you hear over and over again. I overall enjoyed the book. Again, I didn't really learn anything new. It's a great framing of current problems with a lot of honesty and vulnerability from the author that I enjoyed. If you haven't read a book like this, I think you should. If you've read books like this, you don't need to read this, I don't think. The next book I'm going to talk about a little more in depth. I think you should read this book. I think everybody should read this book. I think every American should read this book. It's called How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them by Barbara F. Walter. This was published, January 6, 2022. It's a short book. It's 300 pages. It's an academic look. So it sounds very like sensational, but I found it to be balanced. It's an academic look by a political scientist reviewing the civil wars of like Syria and Yugoslavia and Myanmar and Philippines and Rwanda and other conflicts like in Ireland and South Africa and a lot of other countries. She talks about these and reviews them. She reviews the factors that cause civil war and then applies them to what is going on in the United States. But this book isn't just about the United States. It's not. I found it to be balanced. It's a measured approach to a very sensitive and volatile topic. So despite what you may think, according to the author, it's not wealth concentration, poverty, and political polarization that causes civil war. Those things do not cause civil war. Many people have lived for centuries or decades under extreme poverty and oppression without civil war breaking out. You can have stability and massive inequity and inequality. I mean, look at large swaths of human history and you find these conditions without civil war. Here are the conditions for civil war that the author talks about. When a nation is moving between an autocracy, you know, authoritative regime, authoritarian, whatever, when they're sliding between autocracy and more of a representative parliamentary democracy, which I'll just call democracy for lack of a better word, when they're sliding in between these two things, which is a political state called an anocracy, when you're sliding in between these two states, that's fertile ground for civil war. And here's the thing, it doesn't matter which way you're going, either toward autocracy or toward democracy, the power shifts create the conditions. The tectonic shifts of power create the conditions. And anocracy is a semi-democratic government that has been loosely defined as part of a democracy, but it has like a non-dynamic regime or political parties in place that mixes features from both democracies and autocracies. Many modern governments are anocracies, including, in my opinion, the United States. So you take this anocratic state, and that sets the stage, and then the spark that leads to civil war is ethnic factionalization. That's it. Those are the ingredients. Moving between being in an anocratic state, shifting between democracy or authoritarian, and then having ethnic factionalization. And then when you take those ingredients of anocracy and ethnic factionalization, and you bake it in an oven of social media and disinformation, very bad things can happen. When the dominant ethnic group that has enjoyed long-term rights and privileges, which the author terms the sons of soil, when they feel their power threatened, that leads to ethnic factionalization.
once racial resentment rises with demographic shifts, either from changing fertility rates or immigration, a quote, ethnic entrepreneur, which is basically a nativist populist politician, they can come along with all their dog whistles and dehumanization of the underclass, and this unites the dominant racial group that fears their culture and their cultural and economic power loosening. It is when the dominant group becomes disillusioned with the government and feels the trajectory of their power slipping when they factionalize. When this happens, the moderate bulk of the populace then falls into the black hole of extremism, and they start supporting populist and nativist leaders. Of course, also, when actually oppressed groups, not the dominant ethnic group, but actually oppressed people by the government, when they feel their own influence and power slipping, and when they have failed protests and hopelessness, and there's no government concessions, extremism and violence can flow from that, which we see in, like, which happened in Syria, and or what happens with, like, Hamas, right? It's a good example. Modern-day civil wars are not fought like traditional civil wars. Central governments are way too powerful for, militias, civilian militias, and paramilitary groups to fight on a battlefield. That's not what it looks like. That's not how it will look. As seen in, like, Myanmar and many other countries, social media is used to normalize the rhetoric and radicalize prior moderates, and then decentralize paramilitary groups, then execute guerrilla warfare and domestic terrorism. Disinformation is promulgated to obscure who is responsible for the violence, and the intent is to weaken trust in the current government and then to force the populace to pick a side, thus spreading the factionalization to everybody. Needless to say, the United States has many red flags. But civil war is not inevitable. As with South Africa, when leaders try to reconcile rather than seek vengeance or power, the populace can follow that. Regrowing trust in the current government is key, and this can be accomplished with robust social democratic policies that uplift people across race and class lines. The grievances of the factions must be remedied without concessions to their violence. Increasing state services and social programs help prevent moderate people from being radicalized. Streamlining immigration and stopping illegal immigration is another great way to stop the flames of ethnic factionalization. On top of that, social media needs to be better regulated. The bullhorn of hateful, racist, populist demagogues needs to be censored. Yes, censored. I'm using that word. Obviously, that brings up other problems, but social media companies are private companies that can and should make decisions about who to censor and who to not. This has nothing to do with First Amendment rights, which don't provide protection, free speech protection from the government for a private company. People conflate these things constantly. Anyway, it's a very good book. It's short. I think you should read it. I think everybody should read it. And I think the author is really smart. It's called How Civil Wars Start by Barbara F. Walter. All right, I'll wrap it up. I have a new book coming out March 30th. So I write sci-fi novels. It's my 7th novel. My pen name is Wick Welker, W-I-C-K Welker, W-E-L-K-E-R. And this is, it's a novella. If you've read my Dark Law series, it's a sequel to it's a 1.5 novella sequel to my book Dark Theory, which I published like 2 years ago, which is a long, like 800 page, huge science fiction epic story. It's kind of an unwieldy story. I think it's pretty good. And then, so the sequel's coming out, a novella sequel. It's coming out March 30th. It's called Dark Kingdom. It'll be available in ebook and paperback and hardback, and then the audiobook will probably maybe like a month after. So you can check that out if you have interest in reading it. Check it out. It's available wherever you online, Amazon, etc. And then I'll just want to remind you about my other book that I published last November called Saint Elspeth, which I think my podcast audience here would probably enjoy of all the books I've written. It's about a physician, post-apocalyptic physician who lives in San Francisco and takes care of a population of like 15,000 people, and she's kind of miserable and lonely, and aliens are around. And there's a lot of factionalization happening in that book. I think it's an interesting book. I think it's the best thing I've written. If you want to read, and it's a standalone, if you're interested in my books, I suggest you start with Saint Elspeth. It's like 350 pages or something. and it's a standalone, and I think it's my best writing. I think you could start there if you're interested, but you can check them out. Again, my pen name is Wick Welker, W-E-L-K-E-R. Anyway, so that's it. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Bye.